Okay, hi everyone. My name is Joseph Hanawi. I'm a third-year graduate student at Princeton, working with Professor David Spergel. The title of my talk today is Mapping the Dark Matter, Mass-Selected Galaxy Clusters from Weak Lensing. Okay, so just to mention some of my collaborators, David Spergel and Vijay Narayanan at Princeton, Tony Tyson's group and the DLS survey at Lucent, and Jack Hughes and Sandra Molnar at Rutgers have been collaborating with us on some X-ray follow-up of some of the objects that I'll tell you about today. Okay, so briefly the outline of my talk, I'll first just introduce the idea of detecting mass concentrations or galaxy clusters from weak lensing. I'll review some recent purported claims of detections of dark or very baryon-poor galaxy clusters. I'll talk a little bit about cluster tomography and how photometric redshifts of source galaxies can be used to determine the redshift of a galaxy cluster. I'll then go into some N-body simulations that we've been using to test some of the techniques that I'll tell you about. I'll talk about the optimal way to detect clusters of galaxies from weak lensing surveys. And finally, at the end of my talk, I'll conclude with a discussion of how one might try to constrain cosmological parameters from the cluster abundance. Okay. So every talk on gravitational lensing usually begins with this photograph. This is sort of the poster child for gravitational lensing. Most of the gravitational lensing in this photo is strong. You see the luminous arcs here. There are multiple images of some galaxies, although I can't pick them out at the moment. But I'm showing you this photo just to emphasize that weak gravitational lensing is all of the gravitational lensing that's going on in this photograph that you can't see. So let's take a closer look. Here, we've put in a Gaussian random field to represent the surface mass density. This mass density is assumed to be in the foreground of some background source galaxy population. It will then give rise to a shear field on the sky. Are you able to see okay? It'll give rise to a shear field on the sky. So if we imagine having a grid of circular galaxies, quite an ideal situation, then they would be sheared as follows. Now, in reality, there's some Poisson distribution of galaxies on the sky, and so they would be sheared. And it's quite clear that there is a tangential pattern around these sorts of spherical mass concentrations, which can be used to map the dark matter, which is primarily responsible for the lensing. However, it's not quite this easy because the galaxies that I've used here are circular. However, real source galaxies will have an intrinsic ellipticity that will act as a significant source of noise. Okay, so can anyone volunteer here to tell me where the most massive galaxy cluster is in this photograph? Okay, good, right. Hank, of course, the lower right. Shows up quite clearly here in this mass map. This was the first mass-selected galaxy cluster. What I mean by mass-selected is usually, in the past, weak lensing has been used as a technique to study previously known mass concentrations. This was the first detection of a mass concentration in a blank field pointing by Tony Tyson's group at Lucent. So there is the galaxy cluster there. You can see the concentration of red galaxies. The velocity dispersion of this object was 615 kilometers per second. Its spectroscopic redshift was 0.28. The deep lens survey is a multicolor survey over 28 square degrees. They could find up to 200 such mass-selected objects from blank pointings. It's worth mentioning that the planned large synoptic survey telescope, which is nearly all sky, would probably detect up to 300,000 such mass concentrations. Okay, so it was a little bit deceiving to show that mass map because it's quite clear that I could have used a variety of techniques to create a similar contrast between that galaxy cluster and the background. For example, I could have used the overdensity of galaxies, for example, taken from an optical survey. I could have taken an X-ray map of that same region of sky and there would have been a whopping X-ray flux from that galaxy cluster. Also, if I had looked at the cosmic microwave background over that region of sky, you would have seen a significant SZ decrement. However, the important issue about weak lensing is that all of these techniques require some proxy for mass. that is allowing you to detect these objects. Weak lensing is the only technique that allows you to directly probe the dark matter, which is primarily responsible for the shear field. So, if you had a mass-selected sample of galaxy cluster, you would be able to address or determine what biases exist in these other techniques of detecting clusters, perhaps better to better calibrate those techniques. There also may be biases according to richness or morphological biases that exist. And then there may be dynamical biases. The populations of galaxy clusters that we're familiar with today could be very relaxed objects. There could be objects that are still relaxing or merging or virializing that we have not detected up to this point. Another thing that you could do with a mass-selected sample of galaxy clusters is that you could test the fair sample hypothesis that's often used to determine the density or the matter density of the universe. Essentially, this technique boils down to taking a census of the baryons in the cluster, comparing that to a measure of its mass, and given that we know the baryon, omega baryon from Big Bang nucleosynthesis, that can be used to place an upper limit on omega matter. However, if there were a significant population of high mass to light clusters, then this technique would come into serious question.
What do you mean exactly by biased
here? Well, I mean, there could be a population of baryon poor clusters of galaxies that have hitherto gone undetected. Right, but what I'm saying is it clearly has its own, well, it's unbiased with respect to the mass. I mean,
no, because you always measure projective mass, so a big cluster, as long as you see it along the
clearly,
line,
and I'll
you'll see it, otherwise you won't.
I'll discuss that ad nauseum in just a moment. But right, the point that it's true that lensing does measure mass within cylinders. However, it doesn't determine on any physics that we don't understand from, basically we don't have to understand the baryons and what's going on in clusters to detect clusters in this way. Okay. It's well known that that the abundance of massive clusters is a very sensitive probe of cosmological parameters. I'll talk a little bit about this further at the end of my talk, but we might be able to constrain dark energy from weak lensing detected galaxy clusters. And finally, perhaps a more intriguing question is there a population of dark clusters that have hitherto gone undetected because we've always relied on baryons as some tracer of mass? It's worth mentioning that our current structure formation paradigm does not allow for or would not provide a mechanism that would allow the segregation of baryons in dark matter on scales on the order of megaparsecs. Although you may be able to cook up some feedback mechanism that could suppress galaxy formation, if there were really cluster-sized dark matter concentrations that did not have baryons, that would pose a serious problem. Okay, so I'm just going to review some what I think are perhaps the most interesting or compelling or intriguing examples of dark clusters that have been reported recently in the literature. There are others that I'm not going to talk about here. This particular set of observations was carried out by Nick Kaiser's group at the University of Hawaii and Hank and Dale at NORDITA. This was a targeted survey of X-ray selected galaxy clusters. So this cluster here, which is ABEL 1959, is at a redshift of 0.29. It's a very bright and well-known X-ray source, and it's responsible for this primary mass concentration that you see here. This is a reasonably deep ROSAT image of the same field, and this is the X-ray, diffuse X-ray emission from that galaxy cluster. Now, the object that's in question here is what Nick Kaiser's group named WL, which stands for weak lensing. That's its address, and that's what I've circled here. It's this secondary peak or mass concentration that shows up in the weak lensing mass map. Does not appear to have a significant counterpart in the X-ray flux. These two objects here are point sources. However, it's clear that this we'd have to take a much deeper X-ray exposure in order to definitively say that there are no X-rays associated with this mass concentration. If this mass concentration is coeval with the primary concentration, then it would imply and it would be X-ray underluminous by at least a factor of 2. Okay.
The mass plot is determined how?
Sorry?
The mass plot comes from what?
From the weak lensing.
Well, that comes from weak
this lensing. Is a mass map from weak lensing.
So what's the significance of that peak?
Okay, so they claim that the peak is nearly as significant as the primary peak. And they've also carried out a series of Monte Carlo simulations on just noise to determine whether or not you would expect this type of a peak just from noise, and they conclude that you would not. They also have detected other...
For their whole sample, because that's what you should do.
That's the impression that I got from, I mean, it appeared that they had done a statistical analysis of their noise and concluded that you would not detect a peak that's this significant from just noise. Now, they have two other peaks like this that do appear to be associated with some X-rays. I'd just like to explain this plot here.
So you don't know redshift of secondary
peak. Right, you don't know the redshift of the secondary peak, but this here is an example of how you might try to determine where that secondary peak is. So maybe I'll just explain what's being plotted here. If you made a plot of the color magnitude diagram of early type galaxies, which are the dominant galaxies in galaxy clusters, then if magnitude is here and this is color, this is red, and this is faint, then basically the brightest cluster galaxy in a galaxy cluster is the brightest object here. The early type galaxies evolve passively, so all the other clusters would be all the other galaxies in the cluster would be around the same color, and then as the cluster moved to higher redshift, this sequence would just shift up. Of course, Hank Hoekstra and Mike Gladders and Yi have used this technique very effectively to detect clusters of galaxies. So if you take horizontal slices in this color magnitude diagram, you can isolate overdensities that could be cluster candidates. And so essentially what you're seeing here is slices. Can somebody turn the lights off again? Sorry. So what you're seeing here are horizontal slices in the color magnitude diagram. So you're getting redder in this direction and in this direction. So this is higher Z, and this is higher Z. You're looking at the overdensity of early type galaxies at a variety of colors. These first four slices correspond to the primary mass concentration, and it's quite clear that there's a significant overdensity of early type galaxies associated with them. However, there does not appear to be a significant overdensity of early type galaxies at any redshift at the position of this secondary peak. So,
but it could be a multiple.
No, this is correct. I mean, it could be something seen in projection, and I'll go into that a little further later. But I think you're right. It does. It's definitely a questionable case, but it's clear that whatever's going on in the galaxy distribution, it doesn't appear to be as significant as what's going on in the matter distribution.
What's the resolution of the mass bath?
The mass bath has been smoothed with a 45 arc second Gaussian. So it's definitely. However, I mean, you're not really resolving. The limiting resolution is about an arc minute. Further questions on?
When you say Z increasing, you're using color.
You're using color as a proxy for redshift because they don't have photometric redshifts of these galaxies. But basically, these are redder slices this way and redder slices this way. Since the early type galaxies evolve passively, redder galaxies just means higher redshift.
So it appears that, look at the upper right two, you have a very bold upper two and right.
Upper two, right. And these are the concentrations that correspond to the main peak.
Right. And if you look down at the bottom row, on the mostly right two, I guess, you see the same thing in the same area as the bulb on the top, but it's missing in the middle. So how is that? How are you getting such a close correlation of two things? I don't quite understand.
Shifting from low Z to high Z.
So you've got the same feature in low Z relative to high Z, but nothing in the middle that is corresponding to that.
Well, okay, so, I mean, there are going to be some galaxies that are outliers from the color magnitude relation, and that's probably what you're seeing here at the center. Is that what you were asking about?
Well, then you would think a continuous change of something.
Sorry?
Then you would think it is a continuous change.
Yeah, it's related. You'd expect it. Yeah. So I'm wondering if there's some aliasing between the two features that you're in some way not taking into account, so that you're
I see what you're saying.
The low Z is actually causing some imprint in the high Z.
It may just be that this is another, you know, population of galaxies in the background. Right, no, I think that's a very good point. Right. There does appear to be a discontinuity there. Okay. Exhibit B is quasar 2345 plus 007. This object has been studied rather intensely for the past 20 years. The argument around this particular object is whether it's a binary quasar or a gravitational lens. So this is a very deep optical image of the quasar pair you see here. That's this is the same image in a very high-resolution Chandra observation. So this object is special because it's the most prominent wide separation quasar pair that is known of, with a separation of 7.3 arc seconds. If you just work out what mass concentration, if this were a gravitational lens, then the mass required to give you an Einstein radius on the order of 7.3 arc seconds would be of the order of 10 to the 14 solar masses. The Chandra team observed this object, and by the way, that's the quasar spectra taken by Steidel and Sargent in 1991. It's at a redshift of 2.15. The spectra appear strikingly similar. However, if you talk to people that study quasars and have a very, you know, spectral gurus, then they'll argue that this sort of thing is not necessarily that uncommon. However, it definitely appears that they are, I mean, there's a striking similarity between those spectra.
It should be exact. It's not exact.
Well, but you could envision a situation where there was absorption along the line of sight or a time delay, which would give rise to a difference in the spectra. Okay. So the Chandra team looked for diffuse X-ray emission that might be associated with a foreground object that's causing lensing in this case. They concluded that if there were a cluster of galaxies that were doing this sort of lensing, it would have to be a fraction of 3 lower in baryon fraction than any other known galaxy cluster. The Chandra group concluded that this system was not a lens based on differences between the X-ray and optical flux ratios, and also differences between the hardness or X-ray spectra of the two objects. Well, the redshifts of the two are at
exactly
2.15. I mean, within, right, I mean, it's not clear, but it's clear that the features in the spectra are the same. Okay, so the Chandra group concluded that this was not a lens. However, Tony Tyson and collaborators have taken a very deep HST images of this system. This is a very high-resolution deep HST image of quasar B, with the point spread function of quasar A removed. Quasar B is where most of the mass will have to be if this is a lens. And Tony Tyson claims that this is the first evidence of a galaxy cluster in the foreground. So he claims that this is, unfortunately, I don't have a scale for this image. So it's a, that's the this is the PSF of quasar A. So this is on the order of an arc second. That's the hole there. I'm sorry, I don't have the scale. Right. I don't have the scale for this image, unfortunately. Well, he subtracted the PSF of quasar A, but this is actually an image of quasar B. So this is a close-up on quasar B with the PSF of quasar A removed.
So quasar A is not in this.
Quasar A is probably up here. And then, well, if it is a lens, then most of the mass has to be at the location of quasar B. I don't exactly.
On top of it, right?
Well, I think it does have to be on top of it. I'm not sure why. Right. I think you're right. So quasar B is the one that's demagnified.
Yeah,
however, I mean, I think it's not quite this simple because this is a very complex lens. There appear to be at least 5 objects along the line of sight that are contributing to the lensing. So,
is the claim that anything other than that black dot is likely to not be associated with quasar B, and that's the lensing stuff? Is that the claim that all the bright stuff is lensing stuff in that?
That's the claim, okay. And. It's worth, I mean, we'll have to wait for this analysis to be published, but despite the fact that it's a very complex lens and there appear to be 5 objects contributing to the lensing, if this emission here is from a galaxy cluster, then the inferred mass to light is on the order of 700, which is at least a factor of 2 larger than the typical mass to light of a galaxy cluster. No redshift for the fuzz yet. However, Tony Tyson is carrying out a very high-resolution, weak-lensing study of this, of the galaxies in this field on much larger scales, which will at least elucidate if there is a galaxy cluster in the foreground, then that should show up in the weak lensing.
So why would it be the host galaxy? Because people do this to look
well, at I think galaxy. Think that the host galaxy of a quasar at a redshift of 2 would probably be too faint to be showing up in this observation. Yeah, I mean, I just...
People have done this host galaxy stuff.
At a redshift of 2?
I don't know exactly.
I think it's nearby quasar/Seyfert galaxies. I mean, I think that the host galaxy luminosity would have to be extraordinary for it to be showing up here on arc-second scales.
And if it's a demagnified galaxy, it's even going to...
No, because then it's not lensed, right? It's not lensed.
So the reason that I've brought this up is to provoke exactly this sort of questioning and conversation. I think that the case is still out as to whether or not this is a very poor cluster lens or a binary. However, it is intriguing.
You said that the X-ray spectra were different.
The X-ray spectra are different. However, if there is a time delay in this system, it would be on the order of years. And you can envision a situation where there were differing amounts of absorption along the line of sight that were giving rise to those different spectra. It's worth also mentioning that there are 4 other wide separation quasar pairs with no apparent lens in the foreground that have yet to be explained. If you just took these 4 wide separation quasar pairs, if they were all dark lenses, then they would imply that you had just as many dark clusters as you have bright clusters. So that's, although a rather troubling statement, it's probably not true that they're all lenses. There are probably some binaries mixed in there. But if they were all lenses, then you would infer an equal number of dark clusters as you did bright clusters. Just from the numbers that they've detected of these objects over the amount of area that they've surveyed.
Yes, but are these numbers also consistent with just, we don't know that much about binary quasars, but we know they exist.
So if you extrapolated the two-point function or the correlation function of binary quasars, then these objects would imply a factor of 100 more abundant number of close pairs than you would have inferred from the correlation function alone. But that's a very good question. That's the two-point correlation function if you extrapolated it from very large scales to these scales. Clearly, maybe not something that is a sensible thing to do. I don't want to dwell too much on this particular observation. I just wanted to. This is Exhibit C. This is from the deep lens survey over 28 square degrees. I'm showing here a comparison of a 40 arc minute mass map and 5 arc minute R-band images of Able 781, which is a very well-known bright X-ray source, very rich optical cluster, and a mystery object that has been detected in the mass map. Here's the peak corresponding to the mystery object. This is the 5 arc minute R-band image. It's quite clear that for Able 781, there's a lot going on in the R. However, for the mystery object, although there does appear to be a slight overdensity of galaxies, it's definitely, the significance of the two mass peaks are similar. However, the significance of the two R-band images are not.
So how significant?
As I said, this observation isn't published yet, so I can't. I mean, it's clear that the mass maps, they don't appear to have been.
When they do these statistics, they first of all, by maybe Tony has it right, they tend to do the wrong statistics. They use this is the significant, but for a peak, you have to multiply by the number of beams in
right.
the survey, and then you have to.
No, I understand.
For projections, which basically half your significance anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I can't vouch for their statistical technique in this particular observation. We'll just have to wait until it's published.
What bothers me is that people make these claims, and a few years later, they get follow-up space, and they all disappear. And they replace their mystery object with 3 more mystery objects.
And I'll talk about the mystery behind these types of objects in just a moment. What you would ideally want to do in this situation is take a very high-resolution, deep X-ray image. This is an image of Able 781 from the Chandra archive. It's compared to a close-up in the mass map. Unfortunately, the scales and the resolution of these two images are clearly not matched. There are morphological similarities that are definitely you know, obvious, we've proposed to carry out a set of follow-up observations of these sorts of spurious mass peaks or mass-selected clusters from weak lensing and have been approved for 7 pointings. This object will be one of those observations, so stay tuned for a, you know, high-resolution Chandra exposure of this field.
So the mass survey is 40 arc minutes?
Well, this is not 40 arc minutes anymore. We've zoomed in, but I don't have the scale of that image. Sorry. Okay. So I'm going to leave you hanging momentarily with this issue of dark clusters, and I'll come back to that in just a moment with perhaps an interpretation from some work that we've been doing. But I want to just talk a little bit about cluster tomography. This is a technique that allows you to determine the radial position of a galaxy cluster using the shear of the background galaxies alone. Okay. So the basic idea is pretty simple. I've put in a galaxy cluster here at z equals 0.5. The sources that are in the background are not fixed in some source plane. They're typically distributed with some broad source redshift distribution. So the idea here is quite simple. If you have some source redshift distribution, the blue source here is sheared more than the red source because of the way that the shear scales. It's basically just the inversely proportional to the critical density. So this is the lens strength as a function of redshift for a lens at z equals 0.5. So the blue galaxy is sheared more than the red. The green galaxy, of course, is in the foreground, and it isn't sheared at all. And so if you have photometric redshifts for these background source galaxies, you can use that to map out this curve and hopefully determine the redshift of the lens from weak lensing alone. No spectroscopy involved here. Okay. So if we just come back to our first mass-selected cluster shown there, they've done exactly that. They've assumed a profile for the mass and fit for the amplitude of the shear as a function of source photometric redshift. This is essentially just the lens strength. It's worth mentioning that you do have to assume a profile for the shear, although the redshift that you get does not change significantly if you were to change that profile. Now, this is the probability distribution for the tomographic redshift of this lens. Yes?
Being ignorant about all this stuff, can I just ask an elementary
question? Sure, please.
The input information is basically the deviation of the shape of the galaxy from round to elliptical?
Well, there's an intrinsic ellipticity.
Or does one also use how they line up with each other?
Well, the pattern around a cluster is going to be tangential. So if you would isolate the cluster center as being the location of some peak.
So the basic information is how these ellipticities line up with each other.
Right, and how tangential they are, and also how tangential they are as a function of redshift. So as a function of distance from the lensing object. Yeah. So this is the probability distribution for the tomographic or the lensing redshift. It was determined here to be 0.30, strikingly close to the spectroscopic redshift of 0.28. It's worth mentioning that the...
What's the error?
Yeah, that's what I was just going to talk. Thanks for the prompt. It's worth mentioning that the statistical error here is really irrelevant. You've made a very strong assumption, which is that you have one object that's responsible for all of the lensing. You've also assumed a mass profile for that object. So there really could be systematic errors, obviously, in the determination of this lensing redshift. And I'll go into that further in just a moment.
So what is the statistical error
alone? The statistical error, I think it's like plus or minus 0.05 or something. But it's really, they've binned the data in such a way that it's not clear what the statistical error is.
From a distribution.
Right, okay. No, that's probably a... Yeah, I mean, it's not really... The statistical error is... It's also difficult here because they've... Right. I'll go into how much of a fluke it is, but also this is really sort of meaningless because they've binned the data into only 4 or 5 photometric redshift bins, right? And so they haven't taken so they've only used 5 points in the fit to determine this probability when really there should have been the statistical analysis is dodgy.
Are you going to ever do better than this?
I'll I'll discuss that in just a moment. Okay, so it's clear that we're questioning the reliability of this technique. So if you wanted to determine the reliability of this technique, you would want to apply it to an ensemble of cosmological simulations, and that's precisely what we've done. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how you can simulate the statistics of mass-selected clusters from weak lensing. The idea is quite simple. You want to simulate the cosmological nonlinear evolution of structure, and so what you do is tile the light cone with a sequence of n-body simulations. From that, you can project the matter distribution to determine the shear at the observer. You can then draw mock source galaxies from their intrinsic ellipticity distribution and also from the source redshift distribution, lay them down and shear them with the matter in the foreground. Then you can smooth that shear field with some filter that you've deemed optimal, and you can search for peaks, and those peaks will be your candidate mass-selected clusters. Once you have a sample of mass-selected clusters, then you can correlate your peaks with the actual objects in the simulation cubes using a standard group-finding algorithm, and that allows you to determine the statistics of what you're actually detecting, how many of these objects are real, how many of them are projections, and furthermore, how effective is this tomographic technique? Can we really create a mass-selected sample in 3D of galaxy clusters from weak lensing? Okay. So what are the advantages of the simulations? Why can't you do this analytically? Well, first, we need to simulate the nonlinear evolution of structure. So there are formalisms like the Press-Schechter formalism that can allow you to predict the abundance of clusters. However, there are alignments and projections which can be quite severe in weak lensing. There hasn't been a study that's taken those into account analytically yet. And furthermore, a lot of those alignments and projections are correlated alignments due to the correlations in large-scale structure. So it's clear that you want to do this with simulations to simulate the nonlinear evolution of structure exactly. Furthermore, there's no need to try to determine a complete or volume-limited sample of these objects because the selection function can be reliably simulated for any cosmology. Furthermore, we're not making any assumptions about baryons in determining these objects. We're just making assumptions about how well the shear can be measured, which is an instrumental complication, not a complication or understanding of physics. Okay. So also, mock observations allow you to Monte Carlo simulate your estimates of parameters so that you can give realistic errors. Furthermore, the algorithm that we're using here is fast. It's a particle mesh algorithm. You can simulate very large regions of sky, and you can explore cosmological parameter space. Okay, so let's take a closer look. Here is a 4-degree by 4-degree field from the simulations. This is actually not an observable quantity. In order to make this measurement, you would need an infinite density of source galaxies on the sky, and the intrinsic ellipticity of all of them would have to be zero. So this is the mass in projection. It's called the convergence. It's basically the ratio of the surface mass density to the critical density for lensing. Here I've added noise and smoothed with a 3-arc-minute Gaussian for the sake of visualization. I've actually over-smoothed. You wouldn't want to smooth these maps that much. And it's from this map, you see all these red peaks are your potential clusters. And so if we just focus, so what I did was I drew the source galaxies from an ensemble, based on their redshift distribution and their intrinsic ellipticity. So I've generated Gaussian intrinsic ellipticities, and I've drawn them from their redshift distribution. And then I shear them with the matter that's in the foreground.
But what do you mean, intrinsic ellipticity? Do you also include observational noise?
No. So this is the
galaxies are fainter and larger errors.
Right. So I've used the observed specifications for the intrinsic ellipticity, but for the ideal case. I haven't looked at how well you can measure the shear, for example, as a function of redshift. So this clearly represents an ideal case. Okay, so we can apply. I've also used numbers for LSST. So if we just focus on one of the clusters here, the most significant peak in our map, Here we've played the same tomographic game that Tony Tyson's group applied to real data. However, here I've plotted the log likelihood rather than the probability.
Can I just go back to LSST numbers? How did, you probably know this, right? How does it compare with CFHTLS? I mean,
so,
LSST is going to be a much larger region of the sky, but
It's also the differences here are primarily, so I've assumed that 80% of the galaxies will have photometric redshifts. That is perhaps a reasonable assumption. Then I've assumed a number density of 80 galaxies per square arc minute. From space, you're getting about 100. So,
but there's the critical thing.
Sure.
Those are comparable to your PSN anyway. So if you just use their intrinsic ellipticity, that's
right. And I mean,
very optimistic.
Tony Tyson has done simulations on Hubble Deep Field data, and he claims that numbers between 75 and 80 are realizable. You'll have to.
But you have an effective number density because you have the downwave, the faint scalar.
Right. So this, but that's the number that I'm quoting is how what number of galaxies will make all shape cuts. So I've presumed that you can measure 80 galaxy, the shapes of 80 galaxies per square arc minute, which is the claim, the current claim, though perhaps disputable. So this object is at 10 to the 15 solar masses, clearly a very rare event. Its spectroscopic or real redshift in the simulations is 0.63. The tomography here gives 0.67. That's the position of the likelihood peak. I've put in as this dashed line the real redshift of the cluster. So the tomography appears to be doing quite well here. Okay, I'll go into the error. It's also worth mentioning that so the width of this likelihood function isn't determined by the error in each measurement. It's more determined by the width of the lensing efficiency and the fact that, you know, there's a whole range of matter contributing to this signal. So that's a point that I'll also bring up later. But even if you had, you know, infinite numbers of galaxies with well, not infinite, but if you were in space and you had spectroscopic redshifts, you wouldn't do so much better. Okay. So let's focus on, sorry, this takes a while to fade. So there's another less massive object at 3.8 by 10 to the 14. Again, the tomography is strikingly accurate. Well, the spectroscopic redshift is 0.54, and the tomographic redshift is 0.51. So Dick is shaking his head.
There's got to be at least one case that doesn't work, or else the probabilities have nothing to do with anything.
Okay. So, good point. Thank you. That's a very good point. Here's a 30 arc minute close-up in the convergence map of this peak here. So, the tomography for this object gives a lensing or tomographic redshift of 0.60. However, that's incorrect. There's not a virialized concentration of matter within 3 arc minutes of this peak out to a redshift of 0.4, or sorry, out to a redshift of 4. And furthermore, even if you go down to 10 to the 13 solar masses, there's no collapsed object greater than 10 to the 13 solar masses. So this is just a projection of large-scale structure. It looks just like all the other peaks. The presumed accuracy in the determination of the tomographic redshift is the same. And perhaps we shouldn't be so surprised that it's at a redshift of 0.6, because that's about where the lensing efficiency peaks anyways. So if you just took matter and weighted it by the efficiency for lensing, you might get a value like that. Okay. So what we're touching on here is that lensing clearly measures, as Hank pointed out at the beginning of my talk, mass within cylinders and not mass within spheres. So this object here was the most significant peak in another mass map. I've zoomed in here to 26 arc minutes. This whopping peak is actually due to us looking down a filament or some objects that are collapsing into each other along the line of sight. These are at a redshift of 0.33. There is one massive object at 3 by 10 to the 14, but it's clear that these other group-like objects that are falling into it are responsible for the whopping lensing signal that we see there. Okay. So I'm going to talk now a little bit about optimal filtering and what the best way to extract mass concentrations from these two-dimensional weak lensing observations that are clearly ridden with projection problems. So what are the sources of noise? Well, there's white noise from the fact that you're finite sampling the shear field on the sky, and furthermore, there's intrinsic ellipticity noise, which takes away from your ability to measure the shear at each galaxy. There's also confusion from large-scale structure, and then there are projection effects that we've seen evidence for here. So if your noise were strictly white, and you had some idea of what the shape of your profile or your signal is, then the maximum likelihood or minimum variance estimator will just be a matched filter. So you filter the data, or you self-convolve the data, and that would extract the signal most efficiently. So just a little bit of notation before I go on further. Usually what you would do is you would look for peaks in your map, and then you would rank order them. So you can assign each peak in a smoothed or filtered map some significance, which I'll give, I'll call nu. That's its significance above some threshold. And the efficiency can be defined as the number of clusters that you detect above that threshold. So the number of actual collapsed objects that you could see divided by the number of peaks in your map above that threshold. So I want to make that absolutely clear and not cause any confusion. It's just, if you have a collection of peaks, you rank order them, it's the number of actual clusters at a certain height divided by the number of peaks above that height. Now, I haven't talked about the completeness here. It's well known that weak lensing samples of galaxy clusters are not very complete. Furthermore, the efficiency for lensing peaks at the half distance to the observer, it goes to zero at the observer. So it's not really clear what completeness means in this context, because your efficiency or your selection function is some peaked function of redshift. Furthermore, we can simulate the selection function quite reliably. Okay. So basically, if you have a distribution of photometric if you have a source redshift distribution, so your sources are not at some fixed distance, but they're distributed in redshift, as we talked about before, then you're not really measuring the shear at the location of each source galaxy. You're measuring the shear averaged over the source redshift distribution of those galaxies. So if you had photometric redshift information that allows you to, for some cases, locate the three-dimensional position of the cluster, then you should be using that information. However, in the past, only two filters have been used on the mean shear, and the most widely used filters are just the Gaussian or the aperture mass technique. Again, the photometric redshift information, or the extra information from knowing the position of the background galaxies, has not been used. These have been applied to the mean shear. However, if you do have the photo Zs, and in some cases you can locate the redshift of the cluster, then you can combine tomography and match filtering into a filter that's adaptive, that allows you to search for the position of your galaxy cluster and then weight the background galaxies appropriately such that you can maximize your signal to noise. So the first thing that you would do if your tomography was telling you that your cluster appeared to be at 0.7, you would throw out all the source galaxies in the foreground, which aren't sheared by that mass concentration and are just a source of noise. Okay, so adaptive match filtering is just a combination of matched filtering for the cluster profile and also using the tomographic information to optimally weight the background galaxies.
You also match the scale, because you said that, well, your lensing signal, for the signal, the amplitude of the signal is maximal when you're halfway between you and the source. But not the signal to noise. As the signal to noise increases, as
right, increases, and so that's basically what I'm doing. Is it's just a.
No, but you have to make the size larger.
Well, but there's going to be some size that optimally. I mean, on a cluster by cluster basis, it's clear that you could change your filter in such a way that would maximize the signal to noise for that particular object. But if I'm talking about the optimal filter for extracting, you know, a large ensemble of clusters from the noise, then there is going to be some particular scale that does best.
Oh, because if you go lower and lower in redshift, so if you ignore projections, then the maximum signal to noise is actually zero redshift. but then the cluster is pretty large on the sky, so you have to smooth on degree scales.
Right, but there's going to be some smoothing length, right? But if you smooth on very large scales, then you alias in noise and large-scale structure. So there's going to be some optimal smoothing length for any given noise specifications that pulls out the most clusters.
That will fix your redshift range, you will be more sensitive to
it. Well, I mean... it doesn't, because it's true that the redshift range that you're sensitive to is going to be sensitive to the size of your filter. However, the angular size distance is turning over and then flattening out, so that you don't do very bad by just fixing a scale. You do basically better than you would do by varying the scale. I mean, if
more at low redshift, that's probably...
And also, if you vary the scale, then you run into problems, because then you also start fitting the noise. So this, I found that this is the technique. I'm just going to explain this figure here. Dick, did you have a question?
Yeah. So I didn't. Maybe it went too fast. So have you got large scale structure in the adaptive filter? How did you put it in?
Oh no, I haven't put it into the filter. I'm fitting the match.
Yeah, I mean, this is what we do with our match filters in.
You're saying I
can. CMV, and so therefore, you know, primary is this. Power spectrum of stuff that's noise from the point of view of what you're trying to get, and that actually does address the issue that you were raising. Although, of course, the trouble is an unguessing distribution. But
So the minimum
will,
I see what you're saying.
Will do is shaping.
Right.
Will get rid of the larger scale stuff. So you're going to have a filter which is actually reminiscent, but not quite a Mexican half-inch. And then it'll decide on the width of it depending upon the large-scale structure.
Right. I think you're definitely right. So
it's actually, it's of course what we're interested in for Sinyaya and Zeldovich, which has got many similarities to this, many of the same problems. In fact, it's except that it has the advantage, it's pressure and not projected mass density, which is slightly better in terms of projection effects, but it still really suffers from that.
So right, but it's clear that that's a very good point, that the power spectrum of the large scale structure should be taken into account to find the optimal filter.
It really will change the filter, and it will address what I think it will, except for the large fluctuations.
So here I've plotted the number of clusters detected at any given efficiency that you've decided to set for your weak lensing survey. Versus that efficiency. So this is sort of a strange plot, so I just want to explain. The most significant detections are going to be over here at very high efficiency. The least significant detections will be here at low efficiency. And as I raise my threshold for cluster detection, I increase the efficiency of my survey. And so this is just the number of objects that you detect if you set your efficiency at any place. It's also worth mentioning that these surveys that we're envisioning here are going to have multicolor photometric data. So it's not like you're going to have to spend hours of time following up to see that these are real clusters. You would presumably just go into the photometry and determine if you had a cluster at this location. Now, there are a couple points that I'd like to make. First, I've plotted the best aperture mass and Gaussian, which were sort of the most two popular filters that have been used here, and compared those with the adaptive matched filter that optimally uses the photometric redshift information of the sources.
What do you mean by aperture mass here? Because there are infinite numbers.
So I've taken the aperture mass that does best, that detects the most clusters as a function of efficiency. It's clear that you can vary. So I've taken the aperture mass that's been most widely used, which is, you know, 1 minus theta squared over, right?
Yeah, very bad. if you assume it's an isothermal profile, then I don't think you want to use that.
Well, the aperture mass does assume that you have an isothermal profile, right? But it also requires...
It depends which one you use.
But the point is that the aperture mass is a compensated filter, and so that's not necessary for fields this large. So these are the best filters. I've varied the scale to find the filter that does best. This is the best adaptive matched filter. A couple things that you should notice. First, the adaptive matched filter, or using photometric redshift information, allows you to detect 10 to 20% more objects. Excuse me. Second, I've plotted here the best filter on the data, even if there is no noise due to intrinsic ellipticity. And I've also put the galaxies on a grid so that there's no Poisson noise. So this is the ideal case. Even with no noise, it's clear that the maximum intrinsic efficiency that can be achieved is 80%. So no matter how high you set your threshold, 20% of your peaks will be spurious projections.
But for your efficiency, you also have to take into account the peaks you don't see because of negative, well, basically negative.
I'm saying no matter how high you set your peak threshold, right, even the most significant detections will still be contaminated with projections at the 20% level.
Yeah, but there's also why, in this case, these are very significant. You could have the opposite situation, right?
Right, but I've neglected the completeness because I can simulate that. And it's clear that the survey will be very incomplete. Okay, so it's worth pointing out that for the tomography, somebody mentioned that the error should probably be around 0.1 or 0.2. It turns out that the dispersion between the real redshifts that you get and the tomographic redshifts are around 0.2 in redshift. So clearly this technique is not going to give you precise locations of objects. Also, even if you do have a tomographic redshift, you don't know if there's a real cluster at that location. However, for lower redshift clusters, the tomography appears to do a little better, and you might be able to beat this down to about 0.1. Clearly, if your cluster's at very high redshift, then there are not going to be that many galaxies, source galaxies, in the background of that cluster, and so there's going to be more noise. Okay. And then I'd just like to emphasize that because of this intrinsic inefficiency of weak lensing, only statistical statements about some purported population of dark clusters can be made, right? Because this spurious peak that we saw from Kaiser's group, the mystery object that Tony Tyson's group detected, if your only observations are weak lensing, because of this 20% inefficiency, you can only really make statistical statements about some population of dark clusters. Now, clearly for the case where there is strong lensing, then you would have much stronger constraints.
Can you give us a sense of how to translate the efficiency to the mass of the clusters?
Well, that's a little difficult to do because it clearly varies with redshift.
But roughly speaking, what is 0.8? What mass?
Okay, so here So here I'm just showing, this will sort of answer your question, how much better the adaptive matched filtering does compared to just the Gaussian. I've cut the efficiency off here at 70%. Okay, so the objects that you detect at low redshift are the same. Okay, however, at high redshift, you're doing much better using the photometric redshifts because you're able to discard many more galaxies that are only acting as a source of noise. The mass range that you're able to probe, you're able to detect many more clusters at low mass using the adaptive match filtering. Now, I've cut things off at 13.5 here, but as you lower the mass to that level, you know, it sort of becomes a coincidence that you have a collapsed object at the location of a certain peak. Okay, so does that answer your question?
Well, when you put your threshold to be higher and higher, then your efficiency goes up, right?
Right, okay, and so you're asking what mass does that correspond to?
So that was for 70% efficiency.
This is cut for 70% efficiency, right? I mean, even for 10 to the 15 solar mass objects, like the two peaks that I showed you earlier, the peak that was just a projection was the second most significant peak in that map. The most significant peak in that map was a 10 to the 15 solar mass object. So, I mean, it would be difficult to, I should probably work that out as a function of redshift, but. Okay, so I'm going to digress now for a moment and talk about cosmological parameters, and then I'll conclude. I just want to review a little bit about the basics of how populations of galaxy clusters can be used to constrain cosmology. So what's the basic idea? The basic idea is that the number count distribution and the redshift distribution of galaxy clusters, assuming a certain model for structure formation, is a very sensitive function of cosmological parameters, in some cases an exponentially sensitive function. Now, MAP is currently testing our structure formation paradigm, and Planck will also do that. So in as much as we believe that dark matter is cold and collisionless, we can make detailed predictions for what the distribution of collapsed objects will be and compare those to observations. Now, the problem is that most techniques for detecting galaxy clusters depend on some proxy for mass. So the mass is not an observable. It's going to be SZ decrement or the X-ray flux. It could be the richness or overdensity of red galaxies. The velocity dispersion of the cluster could be used. And also, for weak lensing, it could be the shear. Now, if you want to do a thorough job of interpreting your observations, then you need to have calibrated how mass depends on observables. And that relationship will surely evolve, so you need to calibrate that as a function of redshift. You would also need to know the completeness, of course, of your cluster survey if you wanted to make that comparison to theory. Okay, so just a few caveats. The techniques that are used to compare a cluster sample to observations are, of course, more sophisticated than this, but it essentially, heuristically, comes down to writing that the number count distribution as a function of redshift. Here I've only put in one cosmological parameter, which I've chosen as the equation of state of the universe. Of course, there are going to be many parameters. Is going to be the cosmological volume element times the integral over the mass function from some mass limit to infinity. And of course, you need to modulate this mass function by the completeness of your survey. Okay. The problem is that the mass function is steep, and in some cases, exponentially steep. So you're exponentially sensitive to errors in your mass limit as a function of redshift, and furthermore, variations in your mass limit as a function of redshift or your completeness can mimic cosmological parameter changes. So the question comes down to, you know, are we learning about cosmological parameters in these studies, or are we really learning about the mass limit and the completeness of a particular survey and somebody's ability to, you know, are we learning about the X-ray mass temperature relationship, for example? Is that really what we're learning about when we compare a distribution to observations? So the solution is, you know, use your survey to determine how mass is related to observables and how, you know, how your mass limit varies as a function of redshift, or try to devise a test that's insensitive to the limiting mass of the survey. Okay. So I hope this is coming up. I'm going to focus here on a particular set of models, on two models that lie along a very well-known degeneracy in the cosmic microwave background. Now, clearly, any cluster counting attempt to determine cosmological parameters should, you know, be applied to a, you know, general parameter space. However, here I'm just going to focus on two models that will probably be the most interesting models after MAP and Planck take their data. Sorry, and Boomerang and other CMB surveys.
This is most interesting.
Well, I
it's okay.
I can't write.
Don't say.
I've heard rumors that the universe is flat, but that's all I can say at this point. Okay, so what's going on here? Well, any combination of cosmological parameters that leaves the angular diameter distance to the surface of last scattering unchanged, and also the physics of acoustic oscillations at that surface unchanged, will produce identical CMB power spectra. So here, basically what you do is, this is the concordance model, or our favorite lambda CDM model, okay, and it's being compared to a model with dark energy. W is the equation of state parameter. I've set that equal to -2/3 here. That's how the dark energy scales with redshift. Question?
Is it the same value
of omega baryon? No. Omega baryon h squared is the same. However, omega baryon is different. I haven't had to assume what h is here. Okay. If we had a prior on h, then this would be a very easy game. So I haven't had to assume what h is, but I have normalized to the surface of last scattering, which is a okay assumption if you marginalize over the optical depth to that surface, or if there are polarization measurements that allow you to break the degeneracy between optical depth and normalization. Okay, so if you just for a moment focus on these two models that are degenerate from the cosmic microwave background, there exist other degeneracies. So if I've made this strong case for why we should go out and look for galaxy clusters from weak lensing, you might ask, well, why not just do the most naive thing, which is calculate the two-point function of the projected mass density, or the cosmic shear power spectrum. So this is perhaps the simplest observable from weak lensing observations. You just are essentially looking at the power spectrum of the shear on the sky. That's why you have C sub L plotted versus L here. There are a couple things that you should notice about this. Let me explain the plot first. So these dashed curves are the power spectra that you'd see from the cosmic shear if the evolution of the density perturbations were linear. The dotted curves here are the nonlinear evolution. The red and black curves are what we get from the simulations for these two models. And this is the shot noise due to the intrinsic ellipticity. OK, so what's the point here? The point is that these two power spectra, which is perhaps the easiest observable from weak gravitational lensing, for these particular set of models that are degenerate from the CMB, are also degenerate. So it's going to be very difficult to separate these two models at any appreciable statistical significance, which means that the most naive thing that you might do won't help you separate these two models.
What are the simulated curves here?
The simulated curves are the nonlinear power spectra, or the power spectra from the simulations, for no noise.
Why don't they agree with the analytical?
Because the analytical fits are not accurate.
Even on large scales?
Even on large, okay, but on large scales here, you're looking at, that's, oh no, it's on large scales, no, it's, this is the total, but on large scales I lose, the problem.
So you're using periodic, maybe you could say a few words about the simulation.
So the reason, let me just answer Lam's question, the reason that there's this lower power on large scales is because I'm just reaching the box size or the angle size of my, and basically the projection from K to L is not unique. So leaving out some K modes from the simulations is, right, the width of the kernel from K to L is about a factor of 3. So that's why you see here that there's this loss of power on large scales. And this is the Nyquist frequency of my box. So were there any other details of the simulations that you...
So what was the size of the box?
Well, the size of the boxes are cascading down from a size on the order of 200 megaparsecs at a redshift of 4 to boxes on the order of 40 megaparsecs, you know, near the observer.
And what was kept constant in that cascade?
Well, I reproduced the volume of the light cone so as to reproduce the number.
I know that you tiled, but you must have... Maybe it was a speed issue. What is the resolution?
So there's a couple things. One thing you want to do is you want to reproduce the co-moving distance to whatever redshift, but then you also want to reproduce the volume. And then you're asking about the resolution. So the resolution of the simulations, angular resolution is 0.45.
I'm actually interested in spatial.
Yeah, the spatial resolution is varying as the boxes shrink down. But at around where the lensing kernel is most efficient, okay, then you're looking at about, you know, like about 200 kiloparsec, 100 kiloparsec.
So boxes are the same size in number of cells?
Boxes are the same size in number of particles and cells, but the size is shrinking. So it's about 100 kiloparsecs at a redshift of a half.
Wait a minute, so the 40 megaparsec box, how big was it in? How many cells?
512.
So it was a 512-cube simulation.
With 256-cube particles. And we've done tests that, we're doing tests that basically tell you that you don't need super high-resolution simulations to simulate cluster statistics. I can show you some figures about that later on if you're interested. I have some figures that I'm not going to show in the talk.
But, so therefore, you can't use these simulations to do anything but this?
It's not anything that requires very high resolution.
Well, or large-scale structure.
Right. I mean, the large-scale structure is not really contributing that much to the weak lensing. It does contribute statistically, but for cluster statistics, it's the small-scale power that you're worried about. I wanted to make a couple points about this figure before I leave it. First, you should notice that unlike the cosmic microwave background, this power spectrum is featureless, okay, because it's the dark matter, and it's not just the dark matter, it's a dark matter seen in projection. So there are no bumps and wiggles that you might hope to isolate to use as sort of standard rulers or that depend very sensitively on parameters. Secondly, all the power from weak gravitational lensing is nonlinear, or most of the power. There is some translinear power. So you would need simulations to simulate, you know, the statistics of these sorts of observations. And finally, as I said before, these power spectra are quite degenerate. Okay, so let's just focus on a couple cosmological functions for this set of degenerate models, which will probably be the most interesting models that we're thinking about after MAP and Planck. So unlike is often claimed, these two models are very degenerate in their growth factor. When you think of doing cluster cosmology or cluster statistics, usually people tell you, well, you're exponentially sensitive to the growth factor or the growth of structure. This is the linear growth of structure, but this is typically what you think about when you're predicting cluster abundance. So they're quite degenerate in the growth factor. However, it's really the geometry that separates these two models. And if you look at the co-moving volume element of the light cone, it's quite clear that there's much more path length and hence more volume in a lambda CDM model. So increasing W from -1 reduces the path length and hence the amount of volume. Secondly, the efficiency for lensing, which depends on various distance factors in their ratio, here I've plotted that, the lensing efficiency or the lensing kernel. The dotted curves are the lensing kernel if you assume that the source galaxies are fixed at a redshift of 1.5. The red and black curves are the effective kernel once you've accounted for the source redshift distribution of the background galaxies. So I just want to emphasize that it's not so much the growth of structure that's different in these two models. It's really the geometry. There are two probes of that, one being the co-moving volume, the other being the efficiency for lensing. If we just look at the co-moving abundance of galaxy clusters for these two models, they're also not very different. So this is in, you know, the number of clusters per megaparsecs times h inverse cubed. However, if you look at the total number of clusters in the light cone, or the angular number density of clusters, you see that because of the increase in volume in the lambda model, there are about 20 to 30% more clusters as a function of redshift, near where the lensing efficiency peaks. Okay, so here are the redshift distributions plotted for these two models for mass-selected galaxy clusters. Here I've set the efficiency again at 0.7. The redshift distributions here clearly differ at a very high statistical significance, and the difference between them is basically due to the geometry, the increase in volume, and the enhanced efficiency for lensing of the lambda model give rise to a broader redshift distribution of galaxy clusters. You're essentially probing a broader range of redshift and mass for a lambda CDM cosmology than you are for a quintessence model. Now, so does this mean that we should all wave banners and sign up for weak lensing cluster surveys? Well, there's a point that I should make here, and it's not quite this simple, okay? Because I said earlier that the efficiency of weak lensing cluster surveys is 80%. Now, I've the intrinsic efficiency. So I've set the efficiency here at 70%. If weak lensing cluster surveys were 100% efficient, then you could envision a very precise cosmological test where you just look for mass-selected clusters at any location of a significant peak. There will always be a cluster there. Measure its redshift. I don't care what its mass is. Look at the redshift distribution, and you have a completely baryon-independent cosmological test, which would depend only on our ability to measure the shear, and no assumptions about baryonic physics. However, because of this intrinsic inefficiency, not only do I have to predict the redshift distributions of the objects detected, but you'd have to compare the efficiency in the simulations to the efficiency in the observations, which is again going to involve some assumption of how well an observer can detect a cluster at the location of a peak in the weak lensing mass map. However, I've plotted the normalized redshift distributions here. Unlike some other cluster counting surveys, changes in the mass limit on the order of 10%, which are usually the quoted errors in, say, the cluster richness mass relation, for the lambda model. So I've taken the lambda model, I've changed the mass limit by 10%. That's the blue curve. The test is robust against uncertainties in the mass limit. You see here that the lambda CDM, even with a 10% error in the mass limit, is still much broader than the quintessence model. And so the test is just the normalized redshift distribution of galaxy clusters, which is sensitive to two geometric effects, the lensing efficiency and the increase in volume, is quite sensitive to the cosmologies independent of the limiting mass. Yeah, I'm sorry. Okay. So just to conclude. Okay. So I'll just let you read these and we can just conclude there. That's fine.
Last slide before conclusions, if you put realistic errors into simulation, it's not clear to me you're going to be able to look at this appearance.
So clearly this represents the ideal case, because I put in perhaps realistic errors for the mass limit, but not realistic errors for the measurement errors. And so this represents an ideal example of what LSST might hope to achieve. The reason that I think we were initially excited about this possibility was that I think the believability of certain cluster surveys are, you know, it's difficult to believe some of the proposed, you know, errors that they quote on parameters, because it's clear that there are systematic errors in how we relate X-ray temperature, say, to mass that are, you know, obviously going to be the most significant challenges in those types of surveys. However, you know, in this case, you can't quite get around that problem because of the intrinsic inefficiency.
There's an alternative way to probably distinguish the two models that you show, which might avoid some of these efficiency issues in clustering, which is if you measure the skewness of the convergence, the two models will probably give you different skewness. Mm-hmm.
So those two models are
skewness in one of the convergence cycle. Yeah, just measure one point.
Well, okay, it's not clear, because if you look at the peak, but that's a good point, I think, because the skewness is very sensitive to the matter density. But I've looked at, just if you look at the probability, the PDF of the peaks, so that's different than the skewness, but the one-point function of the peaks are also significantly degenerate.
I know that if you have the same omega matter, which you don't, in this case, in your two models, you think that you don't, but if you have the same omega matter, I know you can distinguish W minus 1, W minus 2, but because they have different omega, they might bring them closer in the skewness. Yeah. I don't know in the end how well it works out.
Yeah, here there's the same omega squared.
I mean, it's
worth
exploring. I think you're right. Dick, did you have a question?
Sorry.
Okay. Thanks, everybody. Sorry I went over.